Dove Audio presents The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. Live in concert.
Is that Douglas Adams?
Yes.
You're wanted upstairs.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I want to show you, before we start, a very exciting piece of paper. This is a very exciting piece of paper because I'm the only person in the room who knows what's on it. It's the very, very latest version of the running order, and they don't know it up at the back. So there may be some exciting moments. Now, the running order is rather complicated because the story of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is insanely complicated anyway, and I've sort of chopped and changed it around as much as possible for this evening, so you're really going to have to concentrate. You're also going to have to concentrate because I'm not very good at accents. There are lots of different characters, and I basically divide them into posh quiet, posh loud, less posh quiet and less posh loud, and Australian. But there aren't any Australians in Hitchhiker, so basically you're going to have to work out from four different accents which character is talking at which point. Now, jumping around here, I'm going to go to the beginning, just for the sake of a topical reference. I'm going to go to the beginning of Life, the Universe, and Everything. The regular early morning yell of horror was the sound of Arthur Dent waking up and suddenly remembering where he was. It wasn't just that the cave was cold. It wasn't just that it was damp and smelly. It was the fact that the cave was in the middle of Islington and there wasn't a bus due for 2 million years. Arthur Dent was stranded on prehistoric Earth as the result of a complex sequence of events which had involved him being alternately blown up and insulted in more bizarre regions of the galaxy than he'd ever dreamt existed. And though life had now turned very, very, very quiet, he was still feeling jumpy. He hadn't been blown up now for 5 years. Since he'd hardly seen anyone since he and Ford Prefect had parted company 4 years previously, he hadn't been insulted in all that time either. Except just once. It had happened on a spring evening about 2 years previously. He was returning to his cave just a little after dusk when he became aware of lights flashing eerily through the clouds. He turned and stared, with hope suddenly clambering through his heart. Rescue! Escape! The castaway's impossible dream! A ship! And as he watched, as he stared in wonder and excitement, a long silver ship descended through the warm evening air, quietly, without fuss, its long legs unlocking in a smooth ballet of technology. It alighted gently on the ground, and what little hum it had generated died away, as if lulled by the evening calm. A ramp extended itself. Light streamed out. A tall figure appeared silhouetted in the hatchway. It walked down the ramp and stood in front of Arthur. "You're a jerk, Dent," it said simply. It was alien, very alien. It had a peculiar alien tallness, a peculiar alien flattened head, peculiar slitty little alien eyes, and pale grey-green alien skin, which had about it that lustrous sheen which most grey-green races can only acquire with plenty of exercise and very expensive soap. Arthur boggled at it. It gazed levelly at him. Arthur's first sensations of hope and trepidation had instantly been overwhelmed by astonishment, and all sorts of thoughts were battling for the use of his vocal cords at this moment. "What?" he said. "B-b-b-b-b-b-" he added. "W-w-who?" he managed finally to say, and lapsed into a frantic kind of silence. He was feeling the effects of having not said anything to anybody for as long as he could remember. The alien creature frowned briefly and consulted what appeared to be some species of clipboard which it was holding in its thin and spindly alien hand.
"Arthur Dent," it said.
Arthur nodded helplessly.
"Arthur Philip Dent,"
pursued the alien in a kind of efficient yap.
Yes,
confirmed Arthur.
"You're a jerk," repeated the alien. "Complete asshole."
The creature nodded to itself, made a peculiar alien tick on its clipboard, and turned briskly towards the ship. Said Arthur desperately.
Don't give me that, snapped the alien.
It marched up the ramp, through the hatchway, and disappeared into its ship. The ship sealed itself. It started to make a low, throbbing hum.
Hey! Shouted Arthur, and started to run helplessly towards it. Wait a minute, he called. What is this? What? Wait a minute!
The ship rose as if shedding its weight like a cloak to the ground, and hovered briefly. It swept strangely up into the evening sky. It passed up through the clouds, illuminating them briefly, and then was gone, leaving Arthur alone in an immensity of land, dancing a helplessly tiny little dance.
What? He screamed. What? They won't come back here and say that!
He jumped and danced until his legs trembled and shouted till his lungs rasped. There was no answer from anyone. There was no one to hear him or to speak to him. The alien ship was already thundering towards the upper reaches of the atmosphere on its way out into the appalling void which separates the very few things there are in the universe from each other. Its occupant, the alien with the expensive complexion, leaned back in its single seat. His name was Waubagger the Infinitely Prolonged. He was a man with a purpose. Not a very good purpose, as he would have been the first to admit, but it was at least a purpose, and it did at least keep him on the move. Waubagger the Infinitely Prolonged was, indeed is, one of the universe's very small number of immortal beings. Those who are born immortal instinctively know how to cope with it, but Waubagger was not one of them. Indeed, he'd come to hate them, the load of serene bastards. He had had his immortality inadvertently thrust upon him by an unfortunate accident with an irrational particle accelerator, a liquid lunch, and a pair of rubber bands. The precise details of the accident are not important because no one has ever managed to duplicate the exact circumstances under which it happened. And many people have ended up looking very silly or dead or both trying. To begin with, it was fun. He had a ball, living dangerously, taking risks, cleaning up on high-yield long-term investments, and just generally outliving the hell out of everybody. In the end, it was the Sunday afternoons he couldn't cope with. And that terrible listlessness that sets in at about 2:55 when you know you've had all the baths you can usefully have that day, that however hard you stare at any given paragraph in the papers, you'll never actually read it. That as you stare at the clock, the hands will move relentlessly on to 4 o'clock, and you'll enter the long, dark tea time of the soul. So things began to pall for him. The merry smiles he used to wear at other people's funerals began to fade. He began to despise the universe in general, and everybody in it in particular. This was the point at which he conceived his purpose. The thing that would drive him on, and which, as far as he could see, would drive him on forever. It was this. He would insult the universe. That is, he would insult everybody in it, individually, personally, one by one, and this is the thing he really decided to grit his teeth over, in alphabetical order. When people protested to him, as they sometimes had done, that the plan was not merely misguided but actually impossible because of the number of people being born and dying all the time, he would merely fix them with a steely look and say, "A man can dream, can't he?" Meanwhile, on Earth, it began to pour with rain. And Arthur Dent sat in his cave and had one of the most truly rotten evenings of his entire life, thinking of all the things he could have said to the alien, and swatting flies, who also had a rotten evening. The next day he made himself a pouch out of rabbit skin because he thought it would be useful to keep things in. This morning, 2 years later than that, was sweet and fragrant as he emerged from the cave he called home until he could think of a better name for it or find a better cave. Though his throat was sore again from his early morning yell, he was suddenly in a good mood. He wrapped his dilapidated dressing gown tightly around him and beamed at the bright morning. The air was clear and scented. The breeze flitted lightly through the tall grass around his cave. The birds were chirruping each other. The butterflies were flitting around prettily. But it wasn't all the pastoral delights that were making Arthur feel so cheery. He had just had a wonderful idea about how to cope with the terrible, lonely isolation, the nightmares, the failure of all his attempts at horticulture, and the sheer futurelessness and futility of his life here on prehistoric Earth, which was that he would go mad. He beamed again and took a bite out of a rabbit leg left over from his supper. He chewed happily for a few moments and then decided formally to announce his decision. He stood up straight and looked the world squarely in the fields and hills. To add weight to his words, he stuck the rabbit bone in his beard. He spread his hands out wide. "I will go mad," he announced. "Good idea," said Ford Prefect, clambering down from a rock on which he'd been sitting. Arthur's brain somersaulted, his jaw did press-ups. "I went mad for a while," said Ford, "did me no end of good." Arthur's eyes did cartwheels. "You see," said Ford, "where have you been?" interrupted Arthur, now that his head had finished working out. "Oh, around," said Ford, "around and about." He grinned in what he accurately judged to be an infuriating manner. "I just took my mind off the hook for a bit. I reckoned that if the world wanted me badly enough, it would call me." It did. He took out of his now terribly battered and dilapidated satchel his sub-ether sensomatic. "At least," he said, "I think it did. This has been playing up a bit." He shook it. "If it was a false alarm, I shall go mad," he said, "again." Arthur shook his head and sat down. He looked up. "I thought you must be dead," he said simply. "So did I for a while," said Ford, "and then I decided I was a lemon for a couple of weeks. I kept myself amused all that time, jumping in and out of a gin and tonic." Arthur cleared his throat, then did it again. "Where," he said, "did you find a gin and tonic?" said Ford brightly. "I found a small lake that thought it was a gin and tonic and jumped in and out of that." "At least I think it thought it was a gin and tonic. I may," he added with a grin which would have sent sane men scampering into trees, "have been imagining it." He waited for a reaction from Arthur, but Arthur knew better than that. "Carry on," he said evenly. "The point is, you see," said Ford, "that there is no point in driving yourself mad trying to stop yourself going mad. You might just as well give in and save your sanity for later." "And this is you sane again, is it?" said Arthur. "I ask merely for information." "I went to Africa," said Ford. "Yes, yes. And what was that like?" "And this is your cave, is it?" said Ford. "Yes," said Arthur. He felt very strange. After nearly 4 years of total isolation, he was so pleased and relieved to see Ford, he could almost cry. Ford was, on the other hand, an almost immediately annoying person. "Very nice," said Ford, in reference to Arthur's cave. "You must hate it." Arthur didn't bother to reply. "Africa was very interesting," said Ford. "I behaved very oddly there." He gazed thoughtfully into the distance. "I took up being cruel to animals," he said airily, "but only," he added, "as a hobby." "Oh, yes," said Arthur warily. "Yes," Ford assured him. "I won't disturb you with the details, but you may be interested to know that I am single-handedly responsible for the evolved shape of the animal you came to know in later centuries as a giraffe. And I tried to learn to fly. Do you believe me?" "Tell me," said Arthur. "I'll tell you later. I'll just mention that the guide says, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you remember?" "Yes, I remember throwing it in the river." "Yes," said Ford, "but I fished it out." "You didn't tell me. I didn't want you to throw it in again." "Fair enough," admitted Arthur. "So it says, the guide says there is an art to flying," said Ford, "or rather a knack. The knack lies in learning how to throw yourself at the ground and miss." He smiled weakly. He pointed at the knees of his trousers and held up his arms to show the elbows. They were all torn and worn through. "I haven't done very well so far," he said. He stuck out his hand. "I'm very glad to see you again, Arthur," he added. Arthur shook his head in a sudden access of emotion. "I haven't seen anyone for years," he said. "Not anyone. I can hardly even remember how to speak. I keep forgetting words. I practice, you see. I practice by talking to what are those things people think you're mad if you talk to? Like George III. Kings?" suggested Ford. No, said Arthur. "The things he used to talk to. We're surrounded by them, for heaven's sake. I planted hundreds myself. They all died. Trees. I practice by talking to trees." "What's that for?" Ford still had his hand stuck out. "Shake," prompted Ford. Arthur did, nervously at first, as if it might turn out to be a fish. Then he grasped it vigorously with both hands in an overwhelming flood of relief. He shook it and shook it. After a while, Ford found it necessary to disengage. They climbed to the top of a nearby outcrop of rock and surveyed the scene around them. "We're going," said Ford suddenly, excitedly, shivered with energy. "Where? How?" said Arthur. "I don't know," said Ford, "but I just feel that the time is right. Things are going to happen. We're on our way." "I have detected," he said, "disturbances in the wash." He gazed keenly into the distance and looked as if he would quite like the wind to blow his hair back dramatically at that point, but the wind was busy fooling around with some leaves a little way off. Arthur asked him to repeat what he'd just said because he hadn't quite taken his meaning. Ford repeated it. "The wash," said Arthur. "The space-time wash," said Ford, as the wind blew briefly past at that moment. He bared his teeth into it. Arthur nodded and cleared his throat. Are we talking about," he said cautiously, "some kind of Vogon laundromat, or what are we talking about?" "Eddies," said Ford, "in the space-time continuum." "Ah," nodded Arthur. Is he? He pushed his hands into the pocket of his dressing gown and looked knowledgeably into the distance. "What?" said Ford. Who, said Arthur, "is Eddie then, exactly then?" Ford looked angrily at him. "Will you listen?" he snapped. "I have been listening," said Arthur. "I'm not sure it's helped." Ford grasped him by the lapels of his dressing gown and spoke to him as slowly and distinctly and patiently as if he were somebody from a telephone company accounts department. "There seem," he said, "to be some pools," he said, "of instability," he said, "in the fabric," he said. Arthur looked foolishly at the cloth of his dressing gown where Ford was holding it. Ford swept on before Arthur could turn the foolish look into a foolish remark. "In the fabric of space-time," he said. "Ah, that," said Arthur. "Yes, that," confirmed Ford. They stood there alone on a hill on prehistoric Earth and stared each other resolutely in the face. "And it's done what?" said Arthur. "It," said Ford, "has developed pools of instability." "Has it?" said Arthur, his eyes not wavering for a moment. "It has," said Ford. "Good," said Arthur. "See?" said Ford. "No," said Arthur. There was a quiet pause. "The difficulty with this conversation," said Arthur, after a sort of pondering look had crawled slowly across his face like a mountaineer negotiating a tricky outcrop, "is that it's very different from most of the ones I've had of late, which, as I explained, have mostly been with trees. They weren't like this, except perhaps some of the ones I've had with elms, which got a bit bogged down." "Arthur," said Ford. "Hello, yes," said Arthur. "Just believe everything I tell you, and it'll be very, very simple." Well, I'm not sure I believe that. Ford got out his sub-ether sensomatic. It was making vague humming noises, and a tiny light on it was flickering faintly. "Flat battery?" said Arthur. "No," said Ford. "There is a moving disturbance in the fabric of space-time, an eddy, a pool of instability, and it's somewhere in our vicinity." "Where?" said Arthur. Ford moved the device in a slow, lightly bobbing semicircle. Suddenly, the light flashed. "There!" Ford said, shooting out his arm. "There, behind that sofa!" Arthur looked. Much to his surprise, there was a velvet, paisley-covered Chesterfield sofa in the field in front of them. He boggled intelligently at it. Shrewd questions sprang into his mind. "Why," he said, "is there a sofa in that field?" "I told you," shouted Ford, leaping to his feet. "Eddie's in the space-time continuum." "And this is his sofa, is it?" asked Arthur.
Arthur, shouted Ford at him, that sofa is there because of the space-time instability I've been trying to get your terminally softened brain to get to grips with. It's been washed up out of the continuum. It's space-time jetsam. It doesn't matter what it is. We've got to catch it. It's our only way out of here. He scrambled rapidly down the rocky outcrop and made off across the field. Catch it? Muttered Arthur, then frowned in bemusement as he saw that the Chesterfield was lazily bobbing and wafting away across the grass. With a whoop of utterly unexpected delight, he leapt down the rock and plunged off in hectic pursuit of Ford Prefect and the irrational piece of furniture. They careered wildly through the grass, leaping, laughing, shouting instructions to each other to head the thing off this way or that way. The sun shone dreamily on the swaying grass. Tiny field animals scattered crazily in their wake. Arthur felt happy. He was terribly pleased that the day was, for once, working out so much according to plan. Only 20 minutes ago, he had decided he would go mad, and now here he was already chasing a Chesterfield sofa across the fields of prehistoric Earth. The sofa bobbed this way and that and seemed simultaneously to be as solid as the trees as it drifted past some of them, and hazy as a billowing dream as it floated like a ghost through others. Ford and Arthur pounded chaotically after it, but it dodged and weaved as if following its own complex mathematical topography, which it was. Still they pursued, still it danced and spun, and suddenly turned and dipped as if crossing the lip of a catastrophe graph, and they were practically on top of it. With a heave and a shout, they leapt on it, the sun winked out, and they fell through a sickening nothingness and emerged unexpectedly in the middle of the pitch at Lord's Cricket Ground, St John's Wood, London, towards the end of the last test match of the Australian series in the year 1980 blank, with England needing only 28 runs to win. It was a charming and delightful day at Lord's as Ford and Arthur tumbled haphazardly out of a space-time anomaly and hit the immaculate turf rather hard. The applause of the crowd was tremendous. It wasn't for them, but instinctively they bowed anyway, which was fortunate because the small red heavy ball, which the crowd actually had been applauding, whistled mere millimetres over Arthur's head. In the crowd, a man collapsed. They threw themselves back to the ground, which started to spin hideously around them. What was that? Hissed Arthur. Something red, hissed Ford back at him. Where are we? Somewhere green. Shapes, muttered Arthur, I need shapes. The applause of the crowd had been rapidly succeeded by gasps of astonishment and the awkward titters of hundreds of people who could not yet make up their minds about whether to believe what they'd just seen or not. This your sofa? Said a voice. What was that? Whispered Ford. Arthur looked up. Something blue, he said. Shape? Said Ford. Arthur looked again. It is shaped, he hissed at Ford with his brow savagely furrowed like a policeman. They remained crouched there for a few moments, frowning deeply. The blue thing shaped like a policeman tapped them both on the shoulders. Come on, you two, the shape said. Let's be having you. These words had an electrifying effect on Arthur. He leapt to his feet and shot a series of startled glances at the panorama around him, which had suddenly settled down into something of quite terrifying ordinariness. Where did you get this from? He yelled at the policeman shape. What did you say? Said the startled shape. This is Lord's Cricket Ground, isn't it? Snapped Arthur. Where did you find it? How did you get it here? I think, he added, clasping his hand to his brow, that I'd better calm down. He squatted down abruptly in front of Ford. It is a policeman, he said. What do we do? Ford shrugged. What do you want to do? He said. I want you, said Arthur, to tell me that I have been dreaming for the last 5 years. Ford shrugged again and obliged. You've been dreaming for the last 5 years, he said. Arthur got to his feet. It's all right, officer, he said. I've been dreaming for the last 5 years. Ask him, he added, pointing it forward. He was in it. Having said this, he sauntered off towards the edge of the pitch, brushing down his dressing gown. He then noticed his dressing gown and stopped. He stared at it. He flung himself at the policeman. So where did I get these clothes from then? He howled. He collapsed and lay twitching on the grass. Ford shook his head. He's had a bad 2 million years, he said to the policeman. And together they heaved Arthur onto the sofa and carried him off the pitch, and were only briefly hampered by the sudden disappearance of the sofa on the way. Reactions to all this from the crowd are many and various. Most of them couldn't cope with watching it and listened to it on the radio instead. Well, this is an interesting incident, Brian, said one radio commentator to another. I don't think there have been any mysterious materializations on the pitch since all. Well, I don't think there have been any, have there? I mean, that I recall. Edgbaston, 1932? Ah, now what happened then? Well, Peter, I think it was Cantor facing Wilcox coming up to bowl from the pavilion end when a spectator suddenly ran across the pitch. There was a pause whilst the first commentator considered this. Yes, he said, yes, there's nothing actually very mysterious about that, is there? He just didn't actually materialise, just ran on. No, that's true, but he did claim to have seen something materialise on the pitch. Oh, did he? Yes, an alligator, I think, of some description. Ah, and had anyone else noticed it? Apparently not, and no one was able to get a very detailed description from him, so only the most perfunctory search was made. And what happened to the man? Well, I think someone offered to take him off and give him some lunch, and he explained he'd already had a rather good one. So the matter was dropped, and Warwickshire went on to win by 3 wickets. So, not very much like this current instance. For those of you just tuned in, you may be interested to know that two rather scruffily attired men, and indeed a sofa, a Chesterfield, I think. Yes, a Chesterfield, have just materialised here in the middle of Lord's Cricket Ground, but I don't think they meant any harm. They've been very good-natured about it, and... sorry, can I just interrupt you for a moment, Peter, and say that the sofa has just vanished? So it has. Well, that's one mystery less. Still, it's definitely one for the record books, I think, particularly occurring at this dramatic moment in play, England now needing only 24 runs to win the series. The men are leaving the pitch in the company of a police officer, and I think everyone's settling down, and play is about to resume. Arthur's consciousness approached his body as from a great distance, and reluctantly. It had had some bad times in there. Slowly, nervously, it entered and settled down into its accustomed position. Arthur sat up. Where am I? He said. Lord's Cricket Ground, said Ford. Fine, said Arthur, and his consciousness stepped out again for a quick breather. His body flopped back on the grass. 10 minutes later, hunched over a cup of tea in the refreshment tent, the colour started to come back to his haggard face. How are you feeling? Said Ford. I'm home, said Arthur hoarsely. He closed his eyes and greedily inhaled the steam from his tea as if it was... Well, as far as Arthur was concerned, as if it was tea, which it was. I'm home, he repeated. Home. It's England. It's today. The nightmare is over. He opened his eyes again and smiled serenely. I'm where I belong, he said in an emotional whisper. There are two things I feel I should tell you, said Ford, tossing a copy of The Guardian over the table at him. I'm home, said Arthur. Yeah, yes, said Ford. One is, he said, pointing at the date at the top of the paper, that the earth will be demolished in 2 days' time. I'm home, said Arthur. Tea, he said. Cricket, he added with pleasure. Mown grass, wooden benches, white linen jackets, beer cans. Slowly he began to focus on the newspaper. I've seen that one before, he said. His eyes wandered slowly up to the date, which Ford was idly tapping at. His face froze for a second or two and then began to do that terribly slow crashing trick which Arctic ice floes do so spectacularly in the spring. And the other thing, said Ford, is that you appear to have a bone in your beard. He tossed back his tea. Outside the refreshment tent, the sun was shining on a happy crowd. It shone on white hats and red faces. It shone on the trees. It flashed off whirling cricket bats. It gleamed off the utterly extraordinary object which was parked behind the sight screens and which nobody appeared to have noticed. It beamed on Ford and Arthur as they emerged blinking from the refreshment tent and surveyed the scene around them. Arthur was shaking. Perhaps, he said, I should... No, said Ford sharply. What, said Arthur. Don't try and phone yourself up at home. How did you know? Ford shrugged. But why not? Said Arthur. People who talk to themselves on the phone, said Ford, never learn anything to their advantage. But look, said Ford. He picked up an imaginary phone and dialed an imaginary dial. Hello, he said to the imaginary mouthpiece. Is that Arthur Dent? Oh, hello, yes, this is Arthur Dent speaking. Don't hang up. He hung up, he said, shrugged, and put the imaginary phone neatly back on its imaginary hook. This is not my first temporal anomaly, he added. A glummer look replaced the already glum look on Arthur Dent's face. So we're not home and dry, he said.
We could not even be said, replied Ford, to be home and vigorously toweling ourselves off. The game continued. The bowler approached the wicket at a lope, a trot, and then a run. He suddenly exploded in a flurry of arms and legs, out of which flew a ball. The batsman swung and thwacked it behind him over the sight screens. Ford's eyes followed the trajectory of the ball and jogged momentarily. He stiffened. He looked along the flight path of the ball again, and his eyes twitched again. "This isn't my towel," said Arthur, who was rummaging in his rabbit skin bag. "Shh," said Ford. He screwed his eyes up in concentration. "I had a Golga Frinction jogging towel," continued Arthur. "It was blue with yellow stars on it. This isn't it." "Shh," said Ford again. He covered one eye and looked with the other. "This one's pink," said Arthur. "It isn't yours, is it?" "I would like you to shut up about your towel," said Ford. "It isn't my towel," insisted Arthur. "That's the point I'm trying to..." "And the time at which I'd like you to shut up about it," continued Ford in a low growl, "is now." "All right," said Arthur, starting to stuff it back into the primitively stitched rabbit skin bag. "I realize it is probably not important in the cosmic scale of things. It's just odd, that's all. A pink towel suddenly instead of a blue one with yellow stars." Ford was beginning to behave rather strangely. Or rather, not actually beginning to behave strangely, but beginning to behave in a way which was strangely different from the other strange ways in which he more regularly behaved. What he was doing was this. Regardless of the bemused stares it was provoking from his fellow members of the crowd gathered around the pitch, he was waving his hands in sharp movements across his face, ducking down behind some people, leaping up behind others, then standing still and blinking a lot. After a moment or two of this, he started to stalk forward slowly and stealthily, wearing a puzzled frown of concentration, like a leopard that's not sure whether it's just seen a half-empty tin of cat food half a mile across a hot and dusty plain. "This isn't my bag either," said Arthur suddenly. Ford's spell of concentration was broken. He turned angrily on Arthur. "I wasn't talking about my towel," said Arthur. "We've established that isn't mine. It's just that the bag into which I was putting the towel, which is not mine, is also not mine. Though it is extraordinarily similar. Now, personally, I think that that is extremely odd, especially as the bag was one I'd made specially myself on prehistoric Earth. These are also not my stones," he added, pulling out a few flat grey ones out of the bag. "I was making a collection of interesting stones, and these are clearly very dull ones." A roar of excitement thrilled through the crowd and obliterated whatever it was that Ford said in reply to this piece of information. The cricket ball, which had excited this reaction, fell out of the sky and dropped neatly into Arthur's mysterious rabbit skin bag. "Now, I would say that was also a very curious event," said Arthur, rapidly closing the bag and pretending to look for the ball on the ground. "Don't think it's here," he said to the small boys who immediately clustered around him to join in the search. "It's probably rolled off somewhere. Over there, I expect." He pointed vaguely in the direction in which he wished they'd push off. One of the boys looked at him quizzically. "You all right?" said the boy. "No," said Arthur. "Why you got a bone in your beard?" said the boy. "I'm training it to like being wherever it's put." Arthur prided himself on saying this. It was, he thought, exactly the sort of thing that would entertain and stimulate young minds. "Oh," said the small boy, putting his head on one side and thinking about it. "What's your name?" "Dent," said Arthur. "Arthur Dent." "You're a jerk, Dent," said the boy. "Complete asshole." Play resumed with a new ball. The sun continued to shine, and Ford continued to jump up and down, shaking his head and blinking. "Something is on your mind, isn't it?" said Arthur. "I think," said Ford, in a tone of voice which Arthur by now recognized as one which presaged something utterly unintelligible, "that there's an SEP over there." He pointed. Curious enough, the direction which he pointed was not the one in which he was looking. Arthur looked in the one direction, which was towards the sight screens, and in the other, which was at the field of play. He nodded. He shrugged. "A what?" he said. "An SEP. An S-E-P. And what's that?" "Somebody else's problem," said Ford. "Oh, good," said Arthur and relaxed. He had no idea what that was all about, but at least it seemed to be over. It wasn't. "Over there," said Ford, again pointing at the sight screens and looking at the pitch. "Where?" said Arthur. "There," said Ford. "What?" "There," said Ford. "I see," said Arthur, who didn't. "You do?" said Ford. "What?" said Arthur. "Can you see said Ford patiently. "The SEP." "I thought you said that was someone else's problem." "That's right." Arthur nodded slowly and carefully with an air of immense stupidity. "And I want to know," said Ford, "if you can see it."
"You do?"
"Yes." "What," said Arthur, "does it look like?" "Well, how should I know, you fool," shouted Ford. "If you can see it, you tell me."
Arthur experienced that dull, throbbing sensation just behind the temples, which was a hallmark of so many of his conversations with Ford. His brain lurked like a frightened puppy in its kennel. Ford took him by the arm.
"An SEP," he said, "is something we can't see or don't see or our brain doesn't let us see because we think that it's somebody else's problem. That's what SEP means, somebody else's problem. The brain just edits it out. It's like a blind spot. If you look at it directly, you won't see it unless you know precisely what it is. Your only hope is to catch it by surprise out of the corner of your eye."
"Ah," said Arthur, "then that's why..."
"Yes," said Ford, who knew what Arthur was going to say. "You've been jumping up at yes, down and blinking at yes, and I think you've got the message."
"I can see it," said Arthur. "It's a spaceship."